from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is the Artistic Heart Podcast, a podcast with an artistic heart and soul, with Anna Mead and Jack Wallen.
Welcome back to the Artistic Heart Podcast, the podcast with art and soul. My name is Jack Wallen, and I am here with my lovely person,
Anna Mead.
What do we call each other? I mean, we're just
co-hosts.
Co-hosts, yes.
Yeah.
But even that, it's like, eh.
It does. It sounds kind of lame.
It does. It really does.
Your friend and compatriot on this journey.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way to put it. Today's episode is rather special for me because it's something that I have been talking about ad nauseum on every possible platform I can find for over 2 decades.
Wow.
And it is all about cause and effect. And it's something that I think every artist needs to start paying closer attention to, whether you're on stage in rehearsal, whether you're writing a book, painting a picture, writing a song, performing a song, a dance, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just one of those things that is not, I don't believe, it's not taught enough mm-hmm. in schools, by directors, by writing coaches, by anybody. And it's something that can completely alter the course of your artistic career.
Wow.
That's how strongly I feel.
That's a big promise for this episode.
It really is. So first I want to talk about where this came from. I studied Meisner in graduate school. And if anybody out there listening has ever studied Meisner, probably the first thing that came out of your mouth when you heard that name was, oh.
I like now, Meisner.
I do too.
Yeah,
the Meisner technique made me the actor who I am. Well, it helped to make me who I am. But it also kind of applies to other artistic endeavors. But
can you sketch it out a little for people who aren't familiar?
The Meisner technique is really about behaving truthfully under given circumstances. That's really the gist of the Meisner technique. And so, whereas the Stanislavski technique asks actors to call upon their emotional memories mm-hmm. and apply them within a scene. So like you're in a scene where someone is breaking up with you and it breaks your heart. The Stanislavski technique would call upon you to use a part of your past, a moment in your past that would have brought you to that same place. Whereas the Meisner technique roots itself in the given circumstances, what's happening right then and there. Hmm. And you can use, typically what is done with Meisner technique is you invent, like if you're coming into that scene, you would invent a circumstance outside of that to bring you into the scene. But that all that did was propel you into it. And then what you have to do is you have to really just exist within the world, the universe that is created on stage. Right. And everything, every action that you make is a reaction to what your partner is giving you. Mm-hmm. And it's very genuine and it's very in the moment. Now, the problem with the Meisner technique, I think, and this is not to cut down anybody who has ever taught Meisner, because it's really hard to teach. And I think the difficulty in teaching Meisner lies in the very beginning of it, because I think what happens is that the beginning stages of the Meisner technique asks these young actors to call upon tools that they might not have yet. Right. Because the beginning of the Meisner technique is rooted in what's called the repetition exercise, wherein two people will stand across from each other and they will just wait until something happens. And they'll just stand and they'll face each other. And all of a sudden, one of the partners will say, "You're wearing a blue shirt." And then the partner says, "I'm wearing a blue shirt." And then the other person says, "You're wearing a blue shirt." And then they repeat that back and forth. until it organically changes.
It's excruciating if you
It is really excruciating. And even one of the hardest parts about it is you walk away from it going, what did I just do? Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. And I truly didn't get Meisner until I was about 3 years post-graduate school. And I was doing a show and I was like, oh, that's what it was all about. And I really think the problem is the fact that the early stages of the Meisner technique is demanding that these students call upon a level of subtlety that they might not have. That they might not have the skills honed well enough to be able to pick up on those subtle cues. And on top of which, just saying, we're just going to repeat this. And then you're repeating this, you're repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, and your teacher says, you're indicating. Well, I'm just repeating what they said. And then you're indicating an emotion. You're letting the fact that you're repeating frustrate you instead of what your partner is saying frustrate. So it gets mired in this layer of subtlety that is just so difficult.
It's
to comprehend
granular.
What's that?
It's very granular.
It is. Like, it is incredibly granular.
You get down to the very nuts and bolts on such a microscopic level.
Yeah. And especially when you're, and this is where I was. I was coming straight out of undergraduate school. And I was young, and I wasn't ready for that level of subtlety. Mm-hmm. I was not about the subtleness at that level. I reached it, but... So anyway,
you touch your chest and yell.
Yeah, exactly. So after I was out of graduate school and I started teaching undergraduate actors, and the powers that be in the university wanted me to try to start, you know, introducing concepts of Meisner into the class, I realized that my students weren't ready for that. And I tried it. I said, we're going to do repetition exercises. And 2 days into that, they were like, I don't understand what we're doing. And I immediately thought, I feel your pain. Mm. And I don't want you to go through what I went through. So I stepped back and I said, how can I help these students better understand this technique? What tools do they already have? Now, this particular class of students were very much in tune with music. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try to use music for this. So what I did is I set them up with an exercise wherein I would partner them up and I would play a song. And both partners had to listen to the song. And I always told them, you don't just listen with your ears. You're listening with everything, your heart, your soul, your mind, your ears, your eyes, everything. And once you finally feel like you have connected, truly and profoundly connected to that song, stand in place, but start moving something. Move your arms, your head, whatever, okay? And once somebody starts moving, you know, whether you're waving your hand or your arm or whatever, your partner has to start repeating your movement, okay? And once you guys have finally connected to each other and you're both repeating this movement, when one of you feels like that movement needs to evolve, let it. And then once somebody evolves the move, then the partner has to then mimic that move. And then once again, you wait until you feel it and let that movement evolve again. So what happens is the exercise is all about truly paying attention to one another and picking up on the subtleties of movement, such that what starts as like a hand wave begins with a waving of the arms, and it changes into almost a modern dance exercise. But it's each partner locked into the other. So it's sort of it's an evolution of the old mirror exercise that we all had to do in undergraduate school. So, but instead, to make it more complicated, it is still in tune with the music. So you're not just paying attention to the partner, you're paying attention to the music.
Right,
and you're letting each of those things help you to evolve. And what happens is a nice cause and effect. And I found that students really got that. And
I
then
like that.
And then we could evolve that into other exercises, be it a repetition exercise or an improvisational exercise. And it was, what the name of that technique is called the butterfly effect. And there are more exercises to it than just that mm-hmm. movement exercise. And I found that those students all of a sudden became so in tune with their partners that when we would start that exercise and I would have two students do that exercise for a little while. And then I would say, at some point, when you feel the movement has either evolved to the point where it needs to evolve beyond your capability, or it needs to evolve into something else, start your scene. And they're so connected with each other that the scene takes on a whole new life. And it's a beautiful thing. And so that's kind of where cause and effect started for me. I mean, the seeds were planted in graduate school and it evolved into something because of necessity, because I had to try and impart the fundamentals of Meisner into undergraduate students that weren't ready for it.
Right. I mean, I think we're also alienated from our bodies, mm-hmm. Especially right now. Maybe yes. dancers are, but a lot of actors, I think, really struggle to inhabit their bodies fully and have the full attention on their partner. They're thinking about their next line. They're thinking about the right. next part of the scene. It's very hard to be yeah. in that moment.
And what that does is it creates actors who seem to only come alive when they have a line.
Right, dead face in yeah. the background.
Yeah, there's that old acting adage, and you'll have to please pardon my language, but the adage is bullshit, bullshit, my line. Bullshit, bullshit. And if you fall into
you
that
just
trap.
Stop listening.
Yeah. Right. If you fall into that trap, know that you're failing your craft mm-hmm. and the director and the show and your partners. And I have worked with those kind of actors on so
it's
many
so much
occasions.
Fun,
yeah, it is. It really is.
You can tell they're not really paying attention to you.
You can. And then mm-hmm. you start playing with them. Of course, you only play with them during rehearsal, but you know, right. you'll completely change how you read a line and they don't catch it. And they read, mm-hmm. they say their line exactly how they've said it all along. And then the director's like, what just happened?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I've only done that on a couple of occasions where I felt like the actor I was working with really needed to just wake up.
I don't think it's always intentional. It's probably sometimes an experience. Their brains are elsewhere. They're thinking yeah. of other things. And it's one thing when it's in rehearsal, you know, unless you're doing professional theater,
right.
most people have lives. They're worrying about work or their family right. or whatever. But part of what I love about being on stage is that you can leave all that in the wings.
You can, and you should.
Anything you're worried about. And yeah. worry about somebody else's problems for a few minutes.
Right, right. And that's part of the problem is when you don't leave your problems in the wings, you are carrying your baggage into a character that wouldn't have that baggage. And it adds an unnecessary complication and layer to the character that's just going to muddy everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to approach those characters with as clean a filter as you can. You know, I used to have this when in graduate school, I was going through a really, really rough time. I was going through a divorce and I was having trouble in rehearsal, and a director pointed out to me. And the next day I developed this routine that I would go up to the rehearsal. The rehearsal was in a specific building, and I would go up to that building. And I would wipe my feet on the doormat of the building and I would go in, and effectively what I was doing was I was leaving my problems at the door. And then right. when I would leave the rehearsal, I would stop at that doormat and I wipe my feet again, which would pick up my problems, and I'd walk on.
Well, and probably to non-actors, that might sound a little esoteric.
Yeah.
But it works.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, if you can tie it to sort of a gesture or expelling in your body.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that the actors, we actors have some really, really strange habits. But the thing is, and you won't, you wouldn't understand them from the outside in, mm-hmm. but from the inside, you get it. And, you know, it's like when you're when you're performing a show and you get there, you know, you get there a little early or whatever, and you see some of the actors doing their thing before they start getting ready, and you just accept it. And it doesn't matter how crazy or how odd their thing is, you just get it. And you could just say, yep, I've done that before. Yep, I've done that before. And, you know, it's just, you know, as long, and I have had instances where I've been doing my thing and somebody has come up to me and I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't right now. And that might sound a little rude because all of a sudden it's like, well, are you a method actor or something? No, I'm just getting in my space that I need to be in so I can do this. Because some characters, some shows are just really challenging. Now that doesn't mean I like to have fun before a show, you know, I'll goof around and stuff, but there are certain shows when I'm, you know, if I'm standing off in a corner by myself, chances are pretty good I don't want anybody to interrupt me.
Yeah. I just read an article yesterday about Meryl Streep. She did method on the entire shoot of The Devil Wears Prada. And of course she plays the villain, right? Miranda Priestley, who's super mean and hateful. And she said it was so emotionally exhausting that she decided never to do method.
Well, you know, method acting is challenging because on so many levels. And a part of it is that Stanislavski himself pretty much said, you know, those first few books I wrote, ignore them.
Right.
And nobody did. And what
is gospel?
Yeah. And we had an entire method of acting brought to the United States and a school of acting that was based on those first three books. Mm-hmm. And when you have the person that created that method saying, you know, don't, you should pay attention. And so the thing is to this day, people are still teaching from those early books.
Yeah, I mean, I've done method to a limited extent. The idea of doing it for the entire run of a show. That's a lot.
I did it for a production of Count Dracula. I played Renfield.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is if you have kind of an extreme character, I think it can work for sure. It's still exhausting.
It is.
I played a murderer in a show and I did method. And I would be in such a cloud all the time.
Right. I lived in an attic for that
show. Yeah, you said that. I remember. And it was like, that's hardcore, man. When you're willing mentally, to put your health and safety. Yeah, and
mentally, I was toast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was the last time I ever did anything like that. And I won't ever do it again because, you know, I'm sorry, but acting in theater is not therapy.
Well, and I believe that you can have a balance, right?
You can
do exercises to get in the right place.
Right,
of course. You can have a sort of limited opportunity to embody. But at a certain point, you run the risk. I mean, I assume we've all heard the stories about Jared Leto and like sending bullets to his castmates on the set of Suicide Squad. And like how...
Yeah.
How over the line that is.
I'm surprised that that man was cast in anything after that.
What, it's intimidating your castmates.
Right. Well,
that's not method. That's just bad taste. That's just, unnecessary.
Did you hear about, I can't even think of his name, the man that played the Joker in the Joker?
Heath Ledger?
After that.
His face is right in front of me.
Yeah, I know.
Was it Joaquin Phoenix?
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay.
He pretty much, during those fight scenes, he went off script. And it became very dangerous, and stunt actors got hurt. And it's like, you know,
if your performance puts other people at risk, you are doing it wrong.
Yeah. And I did a season at Colorado Shakespeare Festival, and a few years prior to that, they had, I'm not going to say his name, but he's a very famous actor. They had a very famous actor playing Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And one night during a performance, and it wasn't blocked or scripted this way, but this actor decided he was going to slap the shit out of Ophelia.
Oh, God help me. If that had happened to me,
Yeah. He was never hired there again.
I guess not.
But, you know, it's like, you...
Oh, I would have just burned the building down,
right,
man.
Right.
And you know, so unacceptable.
And the thing is, here's how we can bring this back to our topic. You know, that slap might have been an effect from a cause,
mm-hmm.
but you still have to take into consideration the safety of your other actors, the
and
sanity
consent.
Of your other actors.
Consent. If he had consent. Said to the Ophelia right before they went on, hey, I'm going to hit you a little harder than usual. I apologize in advance. I'm trying something, you know, just some kind of heads up. Because who knows what could have happened to her, what her history is.
Right. Like, oh, there wasn't even a slap blocked.
Oh,
this wasn't
like a completely, oh my God.
Yeah, this wasn't a situation where I'm going to slap her harder than usual. This was, I'm going to just slap her. So, you know, and the thing is that, you know, I'll go back to that production of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
There was a scene where one of the extras, sort of, who was kind of a real jerk, was continually upstaged everybody on in one particular scene, and it was bad. And no matter what the director said, he just wouldn't stop. And one day, during a performance, he grabbed me and was jerking on my arm and wouldn't let go. And it wasn't blocked, and it wasn't. And I got as Renfield, because Renfield didn't want to be touched. Mm-hmm. I threw him across the stage. And afterwards, he was like, "Why did you do that?" I was like, "What? You started it. You grabbed me, which was not blocked.
Mm-hmm.
So my reaction was based on truth.
Mm-hmm.
You gave me something and I worked with it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect to be, you know, you can't just do something like that and expect me to ignore it. If I'm in the moment and I'm playing Renfield
mm-hmm.
and you're playing an orderly and you're going to grab Renfield and think that he's just going to stand there and do nothing.
Right.
You know, so the cause and effect goes both ways. As an actor, you have to know if I do X, then my partner is going to react. And, you know.
Well, it's so discourteous.
It is.
For people listening who've thought about trying things like that or have tried things like that, don't do that to your fellow actors.
No.
Like, that is a big no.
Right.
And if I were the director, I would have yanked him out of that scene so fast. Yeah.
Well, he did. He got
him out of the show. I mean.
He got in pretty big trouble. So I did not. He did. So now let's talk about, we've talked about acting with this. Let's talk about writing.
Yeah.
Because it's very fascinating, I think. And right before we started recording today, I was thinking about this. And I came up with this thought kind of came to me. And I feel like, and I have felt this way when I have beta read for younger writers, when I have read experienced writers, it's not all the time, but sometimes I feel like writers are always thinking ahead and they often forget to think back. And so, I know that every editor has experienced this. You're editing along and all of a sudden it's like, hey, wait, they got out of the car a scene ago.
Yeah.
So why are they getting out of the car again? Now, sometimes that's just a simple overlook. But other times I think it's when writers are thinking so, they're just thinking ahead, they're forgetting about what their characters just did.
Right.
So when I write, I don't think ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of the next chapter, the next scene, the next interaction. I don't think of anything. All I think about is what is happening at the time that I'm writing. And it's what it does, I think, is that it makes for a much more organic and natural narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because A begets B, begets C, begets D, begets E. And you don't get, if you're paying close enough attention to the present and enough attention to the past, the future is going to write itself. And it's challenging because so many writers, as they're writing along, they want to think ahead because, and I know this, I know this because I used to be this way when I, early in my career as a writer, I could not wait to get to the end.
Right.
And I would,
The steamroller
would pick up steam and it would start getting faster and faster and faster. And I found a lot of my early books would end too soon because all I wanted to do was get them over with. And mostly part of that was just because I was excited to get it done. Part of it was because I just want to finish this story. And there are other reasons why. But when that happens, you're leaning so far into the future that you're forgetting that there's a present that's truly important and remembering that the reader, the only thing the reader has is the present. Mm-hmm. They're not going to read the end of the book first and then go back and read the beginning of it. They want to take the journey with the characters.
Yeah, they want to discover it too.
Exactly. So I think that's why cause and effect is important for writers, because not only does it keep you in the present and keep things genuine and organic, it also makes it really thrilling for you to enjoy the ride as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not, because the way I always have always looked at this is, if I'm not writing a book that I would want to read, then why am I writing it?
Yeah. I think a lot of people, they look at what the current fads are and they write a book on that.
Well, of course.
It's not something that they really care about, and then of course the fad is done, and by the time
right it's the whole sparkly vampires thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Twilight hit, well, it's happened with a number of genres. When The Walking Dead hit, everybody was writing zombie fiction,
vampires, mermaids.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's like, come on, people, write what interests you.
Your own idea.
Yeah. And you know, that's why when a lot of people, a lot of readers will say, hey, what are you writing next? And my answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. When the universe tells me what to write, that's what I'll write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it can be frustrating. It can be as frustrating for me as it is for them. But, you know, because I have been in those moments where I'm just about ready to write the end and I don't know what I'm writing next. And I'm not one of those. I do not like to take downtime. I want to start as soon as I finish one book, the next night I'm starting the next book. I don't allow that downtime, because I wouldn't know what to do with myself. And you know, it's important for me to just keep going, because I know what happens. Human nature is such that when you get that downtime, you really enjoy that downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't allow yourself to have that downtime, you don't get used to it. So you can just keep plowing ahead.
Now, this is for Jack. This is not advice for everyone.
Oh, yes, exactly. Because
like it's worked great for you, but I think with other people, it could lead to burnout.
It does.
And,
yes.
Madness and despair.
Right. Of course. And but I came into this already kind of mad.
Yeah, well, we're right. Yeah, it's kind of a special case for sure.
Right. You know, that's the thing. And I think that my past has really helped my present and my future, because I spent decades as an actor. So I was used to just constantly creating.
Working every day.
And for me, and every actor out there knows this, that when you're not acting, you feel like you're failing.
Mm-hmm.
So as a writer...
Are you a failure, Jack?
No, I'm not. Nobody's a failure. Everybody has a pass right now because...
Right.
You know, but I feel the same way. If I'm not writing, I'm failing. I'm failing my craft. I'm failing the series that I write. Failing the readers. So I just keep plowing ahead. And my brain, you know, my brain allows me to do that. Now, granted, right now, I'm in desperate need of a vacation, which I'm taking one pretty soon.
Oh, but, good.
You know, because I know this, because by the time Friday comes, I'm just
done.
I can hardly put two sentences together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's what, you
think,
know,
everybody deserves an opportunity.
Right.
To recharge.
Exactly. But I think 2 years ago, I calculated that I was writing over 1 million words a year. So, you know, it's people are always like, you know, certain jobs are, you know, I wouldn't want to do certain jobs because they're physically exhausting. And to them, I want to say, I agree. Yes, there are certain jobs that I could not do. But, you know, do not overlook the fact that, but that writing on this level is mentally crushing at times.
So if someone is listening and they're thinking about cause and effect as far as a writer, how is that something that they can control or guide?
Well, I don't think it's something that you control or guide.
Okay.
Because if you are controlling and guiding that, that means it's not happening organically. Say, okay, for instance, I'm writing book X and I'm writing along and all of a sudden I go, oh, I want this book to end like this,
mm-hmm,
but I'm in the middle of the book. Well, if I say I want this book to end like this and I'm in the middle of the book, all of a sudden I've got half a book to write. And if I say I want it to end like this, then that's dictating to me how the narrative is going to happen from this point on.
Hmm.
So I tend, now I may get it in my head, oh, that would be a cool ending. If, and it's a big if, the narrative allows it. Because what happens is as you're, if you're really using cause and effect, that style of writing, then there is absolutely no way to predict where the narrative is going to go. Because mm-hmm, it's going to be dictated by your characters. Because you're going to pay attention as a writer to your characters, and your characters, you're going to write them in such a way that they're going to guide you. And
well,
I know
I
that
think certain genres support this better than others.
They do.
Like I've written a murder mystery, and the problem with murder mysteries is if you don't like set the way, right? If you don't figure out the clues and the order in which the reader reads the clues. And I mean, I think you can do it to a certain extent, but at some point, if you don't plan out these little, like, which is a red herring and which is a legit,
right,
you can end up in a real corner because you can't get to, like, there are rules about that genre. They're extremely strict.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why I don't write in that genre.
Right.
Now,
right.
I do.
Well, because I think if you are, I mean, editors call this pantsing, right? When you're, yeah, like, I'm going to write and write what feels good,
yeah,
in the moment. And like some people are so interested in planning out their plot and every,
right,
little,
right,
moment, and they maybe can't seem to sit down and write. And I think you're the opposite, right?
Yeah.
You write and write and get there, right?
Yeah. Now I am going back to the first series that I wrote, the crime thriller series. And this is going to be interesting because when I think I've written four books in that series, but I haven't touched that series in probably 10 years. When I wrote the first three books in that series, I was at that point in time, I was still using an outline, and I leaned on that outline very heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it worked for me, but that was because the very first book I ever wrote was in that series. So I needed that. I needed, mm-hmm, that because I hadn't quite developed my voice or, mm-hmm, the ability to allow a narrative to happen or just, you know, as you get into this career, you get deep into this career, all of a sudden you gain the ability to know what works and what doesn't work for a narrative. And you just develop this innate ability to simply write a good plot.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have an outline to do that. Now, if it's a murder mystery, yes, you probably should stick with an outline because you do need those certain elements and aspects. Now, with a crime thriller, it's not a murder mystery. They're different beasts. There's subtle differences, but that the crime thriller genre isn't so dependent upon these specific plot points.
Right.
And,
well, murder mysteries are often slightly artificial.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because they have to be, because they have to provide a satisfying ending, and in,
right,
real life, that almost never happens.
Right. Well, I think the same thing could probably be applied to romance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very. It's very strict on the formula.
Yeah,
and
it is.
If you go away from that, you run the risk of your readers being deeply,
right,
disappointed.
I have actually thought on a number of occasions of writing romance under a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
And when I start thinking about it, I realize I can't. Because every time I try to plot out a romance, it becomes weird or it's
and zombies show up, and then there's
I developed this really cool romance series that was about angels, and it was I personally really loved the idea, and I threw it at some romance readers, and they were like, that's a little bit too strange for the romance genre. I'm like, well, that's the best I got.
Well, now, Jack, we've told people that they should not confine themselves only to things that will
You're right. Now,
you may need to come back to it one day.
Yeah. And I, who knows, I might. And the thing is, you know, what I would probably do if I were to write that is I probably wouldn't market under strict romance. It would be paranormal romance. And that's one of the beauties of the business now is that there are so many subgenres that you're going to find something, you'll find a home for your book somewhere.
Well, in my favorite books, many of them are deeply weird.
Yeah.
So there is a readership out there. It's just the question is it something you want to write? Because that's what it comes down to.
And the challenge is, even though, yes, there are readers for just about everything, the challenge is finding them or them finding you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's part of the problem is the more that genres tend to get broken up into smaller niches, it does become more challenging for authors to be seen. And, you know, and there are other factors. There are many, many other factors involved in that. But, you know, it is daunting. You know, when I was an actor or when I first started, when I first became a professional actor, I thought that I had found the single most challenging career possible. And then I became a writer. And then I realized it was easier for me to be an actor than it is a writer.
Well, acting is more collaborative. And it has upsides and downsides.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing is, and here's the man, I almost just put my foot in my mouth. I don't want to do that. But here's the deal. I'll say this anyway. I'm not disparaging anyone, because that's just not who I am. In the world of theater, it is broken down into different castes, for a lack of a better term. You have professional theater, which is broken down into like Lord A, Lord B, Lord C, and Lord means League of Resident Theaters. And it's based on audience size and other things. And at the very top of that, you know, you have a pretty good pay, pretty good salary for actors. And as the lorts go further down the alphabet, the pay gets smaller and smaller.
Right.
And then you get into semi-professional, which is a mixture of actors, AEA actors, and, you know, union and non-union actors. And then you get into non-professional, like community theater. So that has been clearly delineated for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not to say that one is better than the other. I have seen and been in community theater productions that are as good, if not better at times, than the professional productions I've been in. So that's part of the issue with theater, is that whether it's union or not does not indicate the talent that is involved.
The quality.
Yeah. Right. The same thing has happened in the writing community. The only difference is we don't have these really strict delineations, I don't think. So, I mean, I guess you do, but it's not quite as obvious.
Right.
So you have kind of like the big four or five publishers. Right.
I thought we were down to three.
Maybe we're down to three. Pretty soon it'll be Coke.
They keep merging and buying each other. And I'm like, yes. I don't even know anymore.
Yeah. Pretty soon it'll be the Coca-Cola will own one publishing
Amazon,
wing.
Right.
Yeah. Amazon. and Amazon is a publisher. So,
right.
and then you have the hybrid authors, which is what I am. I publish through a publisher and then I publish some work on my own. And then you have the strict indie authors who publish on their own strictly.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, that does not indicate talent. I have read so many books from the big three, four, five publishers that were crap. Mm-hmm. And I have read some brilliant books by indie authors. So that the waters are just as muddy there as they are in the world of theater. The thing is, and the other thing is that there is the same stigma attached. The community theater is looked down upon.
Well,
and it shouldn't.
By some.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think
less so in Louisville because we really don't have that many professional theaters. No. It's probably in the case of the bigger cities. But like,
Right. In New York.
Theater, your choices are primarily community, unless you're really lucky or the stars really align.
Yeah. And in the world of publishing, indie authors for the longest time have been looked down upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true.
And that is still the case. Mm-hmm. But the thing is you don't have that. You don't have that delineation like within states. Like in Louisville, no one in Louisville is going to look down on community theater because, like you said, that's pretty much all we have outside of Actors Theater.
Right.
So, you know, you can't look at an indie author in Louisville and say, you know, who are you?
Right.
Just because you live in Louisville.
I mean, I think people confuse indie with vanity, which it is sometimes, but it is not always. And this idea of like, if you're hoofing it all on your own, then nobody wanted you. Well, the volume that's out there and trying to get an agent and trying to get yourself into one of the major publishers, you could lose your mind and really your whole life chasing that.
Right. And here's the problem is that you may land an agent. That doesn't mean crap. Your agent still has to sell your book.
Right.
And here's the other thing. And I have tried and tried. I have friends and I've tried and tried to convince them of this. It's like, you have been trying to sell this manuscript for 5 years.
Yeah, you could really.
Imagine how much money you could have made if you self-published that 5 years ago and you promoted it. Now, you won't be rich.
Well, people don't realize that most published authors through the major publishers are not rich. I mean, even the really big names are not even a fraction as rich as like a hedge manager
I said this to someone the other day, and I truly mean this. I truly believe this, I should say. Stephen King would not be Stephen King had it not been for the fact that so many of his books were turned into movies.
Yes. And that he wrote in the time that he wrote in.
Exactly.
If Stephen King was starting out today, he would not be Stephen King.
There will never be another.
No slam to you, Stephen. I know you're wonderful. No.
There will never be another Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
There will never be another J.K. Rowling. The days of the A-list superstar mega-rich authors are over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just reality. Because, number one, there are millions upon millions of writers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are millions and millions of books out there. You just have to look at Amazon. There are, I think at one point I read that there were 10,000 books submitted to Amazon every day.
Can you believe that?
That's a lot of books.
I promise and, they're not you know, all edited.
it's like when I open up my Kindle, and this has been very frustrating for me lately because I've been in that nebulous zone where I can't find anything to read.
Oh, I hate that.
So I open up my Kindle and every recommendation is the same.
Ew.
And it's been that way. They have recommended the same books to me for months.
And their algorithm sounds broken, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it'll be like editor's picks. The majority of those are down below in top choices or most popular or whatever, however they break that down. And it's like, I scroll through those. I'm like, none of these are related to anything that I have read.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you choosing to show me these books? And even funnier is I'll get an email. Hey, we think you'd be interested in reading this book. Fear by Jack Wallen. Yeah, of course I would be interested in reading a book I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Are you recommending that to other people? No. Why not? If you're willing to recommend it to me, why won't you recommend it to other people?
Well, and that's like the problem with internet marketing, especially when it's done by an algorithm. It's like you buy a toilet seat and suddenly everywhere right. you go, you see ads for toilet seats. Well, how many toilet seats does a person need, right?
Right. And you know, the other thing that people don't understand is even if you're with one of the big four publishers, guess what they're going to ask you to do?
They're going to make you market.
They're going to make you market just like you would if you were an indie author.
Which is why you should listen to our podcast.
Right, exactly. But anyway, it's 45 minutes in. We've rambled on quite
a bit.
Yes,
there we go. So well, that's okay because this is our last episode of the season.
This is.
So
last episode of the
our
season.
Finale.
So fingers crossed, you'll hear us for season two.
Hope to see you next season.
Yeah. Because it just seems like yesterday that we were recording episode one.
Yeah.
And
it's
now
been a fun
yes,
trip.
It has.
Let's do it again.
So, based on what we've said, give me some thoughts on cause and effect.
Give you some thoughts on
cause and effect.
Cause
our
and
topic.
Effect. I think sometimes actors do that stuff instinctively, but it's easy to get away from it. You know, it's easy to sort of forget that, like, existing in that moment is really key to any authenticity in your performance because that's how we actually live. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know the end of the story, right? So we have to be there and be present. And we may even discover new things along the way about our performance and the performance of others that might just inform our choices moving forward.
Yes, and we can also actually tie this into something we talked about in a previous podcast, active listening.
Yeah.
You know, if you're actively listening, you're going to be in the moment. And if you're in the moment, you're going to be following the cause and effect. And it's going to, like you said, you're going to discover things that you wouldn't have discovered otherwise.
Well, and if you're a plotter, a writer who likes to, you know, schedule everything out on a spreadsheet, maybe try some of the things that Jack has suggested because there definitely is excitement in trying it like that. And it feels a little bit, I think, like free-falling when you do it sometimes.
Well, here's something.
It can inspire you too.
If you're a plotter, I'll finish off with this. If you're a plotter and you've written out this outline for your book and you're writing along and you write something in that book that you didn't expect, don't hold so hard and fast to that outline that you become unwilling to allow what has happened to alter your plot, your outline.
Mm-hmm.
So if
you gotta be willing, you gotta be flexible.
You gotta be flexible. And so even if you build in a bit of flexibility into your outline so that instead of being so specific about what happens with each chapter, just get a little bit more general with it so that if all of a sudden this character says this one line that makes you go, whoa,
oh my,
I've got to go with that. Then you can go back to your outline and say, how can I integrate these two things together? And be allowing yourself that little bit of flexibility will take your writing to a whole new level.
Excellent.
Anyway, thank you so much, everybody, for taking this ride with us this season.
Thanks for this season.
It has been an absolute joy. Of course, it helps to have an absolute joyful co-host to be with. And, you know, it's and on top of which, we're talking about subjects that really matter to us.
Which is why we always run long.
Right. Anyway, thank you again, and we hope to see you back next year. Reach out. Remember, we have a group on Facebook called Beyond the Artistic Heart, and it is a wonderful group that is very active.
You're always welcome.
Yes, everybody's welcome. Find that group and join the discussion. So thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful, wonderful summer.
The Artistic Heart Podcast is produced by Anna Mead and me, Jack Wallen. It's distributed by Louisville Public Media. Our theme song was written and performed by Craig Waits. To suggest a topic or ask questions, feel free to reach us on Twitter at either JL Wallen or Are You Anna 3?
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.